Welcome to If You Love This Planet. I'm Dr. Helen Caldicott, and in this program we talk about the greatest medical and environmental threats to all life, such as nuclear weapons and nuclear power, global warming, ozone depletion, toxic pollution, deforestation, and many other social and political issues that relate to global well-being. So if you love this planet, keep listening. Welcome to another episode of If You Love This Planet. My special guest today is Maud Barlow, National Chairperson of the Council of Canadians and Senior Advisor on Water to the President of the United Nations General Assembly. Maud Barlow also chairs the board of Washington-based Food and Water Watch and is a counsellor with the Hamburg-based World Future Council. Maud is the recipient of 7 honorary doctorates, as well as many awards, including the 2005 Right Livelihood Award, known as the Alternative Nobel, and the 2008 Canadian Environment Award. She's also the best-selling co-author of 16 books, including the recently released Blue Covenant, The Global Water Crisis, and The Coming Battle for the Right to Water, published by McClelland and Stewart in 2007. Maud Barlow, welcome to the program.
Well, it's a pleasure to be here, Helen.
Yes. Well, you're in Australia at the moment. You're Canadian, so you've come to help us with our water, right?
Well, I made the point in the talk I gave that I'm not here, you know, with news about how wonderful Canada's handling our water. So if I'm critical about what Australia's doing, I'm certainly critical about my own country as well. The only difference is we have more water to be cavalier about.
You certainly do. Well, let's look at the world water situation in terms of global warming, sea level rise, people in Bangladesh, their wells becoming salty and the like. Can you give us, that's a huge task, Maud, but can you give us a sort of overall pricey of the situation?
Well, basically, the big story is that the world's running out of fresh water, which is something we all learned back in about grade 6 wasn't possible. We all learned that there's a finite fixed amount of water, and it goes around and around in the hydrologic cycle, and it can't go anywhere. But that's not true, it turns out. It turns out that a combination of polluting surface water and overmining groundwater and extracting our rivers to death and basically taking water from where it's needed, not only for a healthy ecosystem, but for the actual hydrologic cycle to function. And then we take it where we need it, for instance, in big thirsty cities, and when we're finished with it, we dump it into the ocean so we don't return it to the land. Mm. And we are literally physically displacing water all over the world. As a result, there are what scientists call hot stains. These are parts of the world that are actually physically drying up. They're not drought. You'll read that there's drought here and there, drought there, yeah. But it isn't drought. It is literally parts of the world. There are many parts of the world that unless they change their ways, you can always bring the water back, or you can bring it back for a long time until it's gone. But we are actually creating desert around the world.
And what are those areas called?
Well, one scientist calls them hot stains, and there
hot stains,
and one of them is northern China, where China has taken all of its water to produce all the toys and running shoes in the world. So they've removed water from watersheds. They're creating an area of desert the size of Rhode Island every year. All of India, where they've got 23 million bore wells going 24/7, just pumping that water up out of the ground exponentially. Big parts of southern Europe around the Mediterranean is another crisis point. Mexico City is sinking on itself. They've taken all the water from under the ground. There are 22 countries in Africa in crisis, and every one of their 677 lakes are in crisis. The southwest of the United States is in crisis as the Colorado River is in, and I quote, catastrophic decline, which is very much like the Murray Darling. And I would argue that Australia is one of these places that has built its economic miracle, if you will, on the notion that there were unlimited supplies of water. And lo and behold, it's not true. So as a result, of course, there are many people who are suffering now in the world. Close to 2 billion people live in water-stressed regions of the world. Close to 3 billion have no running water within a kilometer of their home. And every 8 seconds somewhere in our world, a child is dying of waterborne disease. It's the cause, the number one cause, more than the next three put together, more than HIV, AIDS, accidents, and war put together, is dirty water. It's a killer. So I feel that the global water crisis is the number one ecological and human crisis of our time. Has not commanded the demand, the concerted either concern or planning that it needs to from government to continue to deny that this is a problem and continue to call it cyclical drought and have this great hope that somehow the big technology will save us.
Well, always people say that when I talk about my issues too. Well, technology will save us. Particularly men say that.
Yes, exactly. This is very much. It is very much a.
A left brain thing. What about in this context, Maud Barlow, overpopulation? I mean, in the year 1800, there were only 1 billion human beings. And in 200 years, we've gone from 1 billion to 6.72 billion. So what role does that play in water shortage?
Well, it's huge, of course. But it's not just population by itself. And, of course, we're adding another up to 3 billion people in the next few decades. But it isn't people by themselves. It's people plus development. It's people plus a way of life, the Western, urbanized, consumer-based way of living and, way of thinking that we have to live. Over the last few decades, as our population has increased threefold since the 1950s, our water use has increased sevenfold. So what's happened is that the more so-called sophisticated we get, the more water we use. And it's that exponential abuse of water that's the problem. And I've been in communities in India, in rural communities where there are, very, very dense populations per square kilometer, but they live the way their great-great-grandparents lived, and they take good care of the water, and they don't pollute it, and they don't waste it. It's that combination. And as we industrialize in countries like India and China, the problem is huge. I mean, we simply are using more water than the Earth has.
So the
statistics are so stunning about 2025, 2035, 2050. No one knows where the water that we need is going to come from, and there's yet no way to manufacture new sources of water.
No, well, our silly politicians in Australia are talking about desalination plants, which are exorbitantly energy consuming. So you either burn coal to produce the electricity, which aggravates global warming, or people are talking about building nuclear power plants to desalinate water. Would you like to comment on that, Maud?
Well, I sure would, because there's a true belief here between the markets and, these private markets and desalination and pipelines and so on. I call them the three Ds, dams, desal, and diversion, that somehow there's the economic miracle and we can just go on with life as it was. And
yeah,
it's just a myth. First of all, as you say, desalination is very, very energy intensive, and it also is polluting. There's a CO2 emissions that it gives off. It's expensive. They're exorbitantly expensive. And ask the people in Melbourne who started their desal plant, and the big banks have just said, gee, we don't have the money in this financial environment to finish it. So this behemoth is sort of stuck there for now. But it's also polluting, and it's really important that we stop and remember that we're often handing off to some other part of the environment what we have, what we don't want to continue to create in one part. Biofuels is a very good example. To cut down on fossil fuel use in our cars, we use land and water to grow food to feed those cars. And now we're learning that that's water guzzling of an enormous proportion, and that we're creating problems with water to solve fossil fuels. Well, it's the same thing with desalination. You are using the oceans and abusing the oceans to provide water because we won't cut down our water footprint. What desal plants do is they release a very intense poison brine back into the ocean.
Mm.
The combination of the intense salt that gets left behind,
mm.
the chemical that's used for the reverse osmosis process, and then this aquatic life that is sucked in and then sucked back out. And And even this morning in the conference, recently here, I've been hearing about, from the technicians who say, well, don't worry, we're just going to build big pipelines and send it further out into the ocean. Well,
oh, yeah, they always say that.
Well, and they will. And then it'll kill the ocean a little further out. I mean, the notion that the oceans are here for us to abuse is really, really a dangerous one. There are a number of new books, one by a terrific Canadian author named Alana Mitchell, called Seasick, but there's a number of them that are telling us that what we're doing to the oceans is criminal. With the big plastic gyres, the gyres of used plastic
and overfishing. What are gyres?
Well, these gyres, these are the great big whirlpools of plastic that exist in the ocean.
There was one in the North Pacific.
That's
how
right.
large is that of a collection of plastic?
Yeah, the size of Mexico.
Size of Mexico.
It's absolutely, they're huge.
Of floating plastic.
Of floating, swirling plastic. And, of course, it breaks down, and then it gets into all the animals, the aquatic life, and so on. So we really have to stop thinking of the ocean as the place where we can dump the problems that we haven't learned to live with on Earth. So, for me, desalination is what you do when you have run out of every single other answer, and that's not true yet. I mean, there's a wonderful experiment, Walmore's experiment, is actually in place now in Salisbury, which is a northern community, a suburb of Adelaide, where they're collecting the storm water, and they show that if the city of Adelaide collected only 60% of its storm water, it would have the water it needs to replace what they're going to get from the desal plant. But we refuse to do this. We refuse to change our ways, and we somehow think that building these big new technologies will take care of things. And it's a very expensive mistake.
Well, I used to live in Adelaide, and we all used to have water tanks, collect the water, rainwater from the roof. In fact, I live in a small fishing village and I totally rely upon rainwater. And it should be imperative, I think, in this sort of time of water crisis that every single house on earth has a rainwater tank, and when it rains, you collect the water.
I absolutely agree with you. But we have gone so far from that. We have gone, it's like, where does meat come from? Well, it comes from plastic in the supermarket. Where does water come from? It comes from a tap, or it comes from a bottle at Walmart, right? A plastic bottle. We just don't have this relationship to water that says that this water must be returned to the land. It must be returned to the rivers and the aquifers. This issue is very, very important in terms of setting a bunch of principles. That's what I've been talking about here, is that we've got to build our solutions on an agreed-upon basis of principles. And if we don't get those principles right and those foundations right, we're going to get the answers wrong.
Well, what principles would you enunciate then, Maud Barlow?
Five for Australia. I mean, five anyway, but very, very clearly for me. The first thing is that the national government must declare Australia's water to be a public trust and bring it back in under the control of the Australian government. Now, I understand that in the Constitution in Australia, water does belong to people in the state. But that has been arrogated by the 1994 law that allowed the opening of water trading between private brokers and the sellers. And now there's more water trading. I mean, I would argue that the owners of water and the water brokers have more say over the water of the Murray Darling than governments do. That's the privatization of the Murray Darling.
You mean the irrigators?
The irrigators who got the water in the first place for free, using public money, to grow food, and now own that water from this 1994 legislation, and now are saying to the government, well, maybe we'll sell it back to you. Maybe
I know, the government's trying to buy it from them. I've never heard anything so ridiculous.
Well, what they need to do is say, this water does not belong to you. It was only ever loaned to you, and it's only for you to use to grow food. And this doesn't mean there isn't a commercial use for water, but we have to regulate it. So that there needs to be a priority placed on this water.
Right.
The first thing to do is that it must be brought back. I call it, reappropriation of water, mm-hmm. of the public waters, where the federal government has to say, this water belongs to all Australians, the ecosystem, and the future.
Right.
Period. Full stop.
So
then
the next one.
Then the next one is, then what do we do with it? And the next one is watershed protection and restoration. If we don't leave enough water or put water back into these water systems, like the Murray Darling, the rest of it won't matter because we will run out of water and there will be refugees here.
We need to tell the people in the United States and Canada, the Murray Darling River system goes from the north of Australia and Queensland through New South Wales, through Victoria, and to South Australia. It's really the only river system that we have in Australia, and Australia is the size or area of the United States. So you can imagine how incredibly precious that is, just so everyone knows.
No, it's very important what you say, and it's also the breadbasket. I mean, the Murray Darling is where all of the agriculture takes place and where all the food is grown. So that would be the first. The second, but this isn't just, of course, for Australia. I mean, I think these five principles, as they say, the second would be the water restoration,
yes,
making sure that we put enough back into the system that it's safe. The third would be conservation. And this is what I call the soft path as opposed to the hard path of high technology.
Yeah.
The soft path is conservation. It's a different form of food production, much more local, much more sustainable.
Mm.
It's very strict around pollution of water, and if you mean it, you pass a law saying you mean it, and you affect that, so that you do have a very, very strict code of conservation, and that means collecting the storm water, collecting the gray water, new building codes, all of that.
Mm.
The next principle is basically fair allocation, justice. We have got to build a world on the notion of water justice. And that means that no one should be denied water because they cannot afford to pay for it.
Yep.
So we have to say that the water for living and general life, if you will, comes first, and local sustainable food production comes before commercial use.
Right.
What I tell people about what the state of Vermont has done, because I think it's one of the better pieces of legislation around, they said they just passed a law a year ago because they have a lot of good water, groundwater, which was unprotected. And all these big bottled water companies were coming in and pumping it up, sending it to thirsty cities in, California and so on. And they passed a law saying this water belongs to all the people of Vermont, that the ecosystem and the future, and you can't just have it. If you use more than a certain amount of per day, you have to have it licensed. We will give you a permit. You have to pay for it.
Mm.
And we have the right to revoke that if we feel that your use is unsustainable.
Mm.
So the control is always back to the people, through their government, but
yep,
it's to the people. And I guess the last principle is one we're working really hard on at the United Nations, and that is that water is a human right.
Yep.
And this, sounds like a semantic thing. I just came from Istanbul at the World Water Forum, where we had a really duked it out around this issue, because the World Water Forum says, no, it's just a need, which means that the private sector can deliver it on a for-profit basis. Well, if somebody's helping themselves to water on for profit, then there's somebody else is being denied that water because they cannot pay for it. And we need to establish once and for all that water is not running shoes, water is not Coca-Cola, water is what you need for life. And no one should be denied water from an inability to pay. And we're hoping that nation-state constitutions will be, amended to reflect this. And we also want a full covenant or treaty at the United Nations saying once and for all, and settling once and for all, that water is a fundamental human right.
Well, now, Maud Bullough, talk about in recent decades the notion of privatization of water, because I'm always absolutely shocked to my back teeth when I hear that corporations are moving into countries and saying, we own the water and you've got to buy it from us.
Well, they most certainly do. And in the Global South, they've been promoted by the World Bank and the other regional development banks very strongly. I mean, to the exclusion of public.
Really?
For about 15, 16 years now, the World Bank has basically extended money for water services in the Global South contingent upon accepting private companies. And and usually it's one of the two biggest in the world. They're called Suez. They built the Suez Canal. And Veolia. Both of these are big French companies from France who run the water systems in France for 120 years, who, by the way, are about to lose their contract for the first time in the city of Paris. It's going to go public, which everybody's very excited about. but that who are all over the global south and all in some parts of the global north, delivering water on a for-profit basis to people who can afford it. And what they do is, because they have to take the same amount of public money, and it is always public money, we do not invest their own money, but they have to make a profit from it for their shareholders, they have to cut corners. So generally they lay off workers, they jack up the rate of water very, very highly. In some cases they triple the rate of water. They cut corners often in terms of the quality of water, and you know, there is a ferocious fight taking place in communities around the world, from La Paz, Bolivia, to Buenos Aires in Argentina, both of which have just kicked Suez out, to Atlanta, Georgia, which just kicked Suez out a couple of years ago. 3 years into a 20-year contract, they said, "Get out, don't come back. You know, we can't believe what you did to our water system." But this is a mantra that governments believe, either because they've bought into the notion that the private sector can always do it better, or municipalities are cash-strapped, or governments in poor countries are cash-strapped, and they're told by the World Bank, well, the only way you're going to get any funding is if you bring these companies in. And it's a fierce, fierce battle in the global south around this issue around the right to water. That's what people in the global south mean by the right to water, public water, not for profit water.
What is the world? I mean, this is obscene, Maud, that the World Bank, that was supposed to be set up to help developing countries in the third world, you know, really actually supports private companies to go in and totally exploit the natural resources in the third world.
Well, it's been so controversial and proven to be so such a disaster that even the United Nations, which under Kofi Annan supported privatization projects.
Did he really?
Oh, yeah. That was a very big
concern. Why? He was really just an American.
I think that he really felt that playing with the big boys meant playing with the World Bank and the IMF.
Oh.
And it was under Kofi Annan that the UN set up this thing called the Global Compact, which is a voluntary agreement between the United Nations and a bunch of big corporations, some of them really, you know, still environmental abusers and human rights abusers, to, you know, basically say, well, we'll try to clean up our act, or we've made this agreement. But they've been very highly criticized because, you know, many of these companies kind of wrap themselves in the UN flag. Well, now there's one for just the water companies. It's called the CEO Water Mandate, working with the United Nations. Again, it's all the big bottled water companies, the big water utility companies.
Oh.
And I, as somebody who's advising the president of the UN General Assembly, I criticize this corporate influence and corporate involvement in the one international institution left that, unlike the WTO, the World Trade Organization, or the World Bank, has not been kind of taken over by these corporate interests. So, yeah, it's a very serious problem.
They've been bought off. Well, what happens to the poor people in these countries if they? How can they afford water for their?
Well, they can't.
What happens?
They either. Well, I'll give you a couple of examples. In Johannesburg, South Africa, in the townships, the Suez came in. It's called Johannesburg Water, but it's a subsidiary of Suez, and they bring water into the townships, but they put prepaid water meters on. And, I mean, I remember standing in one of the townships and, you know, burning tires and garbage and, you know, really dirty place. They have what they call flying toilets, which is where you defecate into plastic bags and you just throw them. You can imagine what it's like when it rains.
Oh.
But suddenly, finally, they have water coming into these communities, one per block, one of these pipes per block. But between the pipe and the tap is a state-of-the-art water meter. And the only way to get water from this is to pay money to charge up your electronic key, then you touch this water meter, and we actually filmed it. Every single drop is charged to you. Well, when you're talking 80-85% unemployment in a community like that, people just kind of laugh. And then, well, laugh and cry, and then they take their buckets and they walk 5 kilometers to a river that has cholera warning signs
yes.
on it, and that's what they use.
They drink
you know,
polluted water.
So
this
and or they buy water from private vendors at many more times the amount than they would have had to pay have they been able to hook up to the system, but they can't.
Why don't they break the meters?
They do. They do. And in fact, what I love in South Africa is some of the municipal workers, South African water workers, come out and they install the meters during the day, and they come back at night when they're off duty, and they show people how to dismantle. So it's one of my favorite stories.
You know, I've always thought all this privatization of water and people walking around with these blasted water bottles, which actually contain hormone mimickers, which can stimulate the growth of breast cancer and all sorts of dreadful things. I just did a show on that yesterday. You know, soon we'll be walking around with oxygen bottles on our back and they'll privatize the air.
Well, you know, in a way, carbon emission trading is exactly privatizing the air. I mean, it is, you know, the whole notion of being able to buy your way out of polluting is a form of privatization of the air. But I absolutely agree with you. You know, we keep talking about the commons, or some of us are talking about it, and I've just written a report called Our Water Commons.
Mm.
And a lot of us are trying to talk about how to take back the notion of the commons, which was very much a part of thinking in many communities around the world.
Mm.
And then the modern enclosure of the commons, of course, is privatization of these areas that we once thought were just sacred. Even I would include healthcare.
Certainly in America.
And education need
yep.
to be seen as I would say, as commons. But certainly there's nothing that you could point to that is more urgently needed to be designated a commons than water, when the commons and a public trust. But you're right, the bottled water industry, and the bottled water is really one of the ways in which we start the privatization process.
Yeah.
Because if you've decided you're not going to trust that tap water, and you're going to only go to bottled water, then you're not going to care what comes out of that tap, and therefore you're not going to maybe want to pay taxes to make sure that tap water is clean, or that the infrastructure was upgraded, or that the source was protected, because you've lost faith in it.
But also, you don't know where the bottled water is coming from.
Listen,
I mean,
there are so many studies now that tell us that not only is that bottled water not necessarily safer, it's probably not as safe. It's nowhere near as regulated and tested. We just had a big scandal in Canada where it was admitted by the Food Inspection Agency, our government department at Health Canada that actually inspects bottled water, that they haven't inspected a bottled water plant in 6 years in Canada. It's totally and completely left up to the industry to regulate.
Oh, well, you know, when I wrote my book, If You Love This Planet, in 1992, I've just revised it, but I remember reading that the mafia used to take toxic waste and the like and tipped it into the aquifers in Vermont.
Right.
And then, as you just mentioned earlier in the program, that's where a lot of these companies get their water from. So nobody, I mean, you know, when you think of Coors Beer, which was just next to the Rocky Flats plutonium production plant, and there was plutonium, there was a huge fire there, and it spread all over the place. I mean, people have no idea where this water comes from.
They just assume that if it's in a nice bottle,
yeah.
you know, with a nice little marketing tool, that it's fine. It's that we've had a real fight back in Canada. We've now had 27 municipalities, and most of them are big cities, ban commercial sale of bottled water. This has been a real campaign that we've had. We've had dozens of school boards across the country, and we just had a meeting of the Federation of Canadian Municipalities at their annual meeting last month, passed a motion for a full ban across the country. That is that the single bottle, plastic bottle containers, they will not provide or sell on their premises, and it makes sense. If you are putting all this money into cleaning water and testing it and regulating it, and protecting source and all of that stuff, why would you then compete with that by providing and promoting bottled water sales? So there's a real fight back. A lot of restaurants are now moving to their own filtering and so on.
You don't need to filter tap. I mean, in developed countries, the water is totally potable that comes out
it's
of the taps.
Totally, perfectly safe, and it's foolish to worry about it. But a lot of people have bought into that mythology. I mean, I walk down the street here in Australia with all of the water crisis, and people are guzzling bottled water. So it's a real mythology that, and as you say, we know now from recent studies that if that plastic is left in the sun, or sits in a car and those rays get through the sun, through the window and heat that water up, and then you put it in a cooler to cool it down. You shouldn't be drinking that water.
No, that's right. It's big. And production of plastic produces nasty carcinogens, which are thrown up into the air.
Absolutely, and CO2 emissions.
Yeah, and then if you burn plastic, it turns into dioxins and other nasty things. And then if you don't, it stays, you know, in the rubbish tips for 500 years or more, the whole thing.
Yeah.
And I'll tell you what, people in swimming pools are always guzzling bottled water, and people running have their water attached to their belt and stuff. It's like the Freudian oral anal stage. Everyone has to have sort of like a bottle, and if it's not milk, it's water.
Oh, we had a wonderful tour recently in Ontario, my province in Canada, called the Unbottle It Tour, and there was this kid came up to the mic in braces. He must have been about 14.
Yeah.
He said, look, I'm not trying to disagree with you. I'm so upset by everything you said, because we talked about how much pollution is, you know, and how much energy is used to make the plastic and so on. But he said, I can't imagine being without my bottle of water. And he was really serious. And I said, well, you're going to not believe this, but there was a time, once upon a time, when people ventured out without their, you know, hydration vehicle or, you know, tool on their hip.
And but people think that, you know, this is a myth too, medically, that the more water they drink, the healthier they are.
Well, that's a marketing thing. That came from the bottled water companies. Absolutely. Well, you have to have your 8 liters a day. That is not true.
That's ridiculous.
If you drink that, if you're drinking more than you want, your body's telling you you're drinking too much.
Yep.
And just a nice little aside here, and this is the one that gets people for me. In one Canadian city, and this would be comparable in any municipality, anywhere in the developed world where water is public, they said if you do drink those 8 glasses a day, and this is in London, Ontario, every day for a year, it would cost you $1.88 for all that water. If you go to a vending machine and drink that, it's going to cost you $2,190. So when I tell people that, and I say, you want to save money, you know, there's a good spot.
Well, let alone the strain on the poor old kidneys that have to filter out all this extra water. It's ridiculous.
Absolutely.
Now, there are two other things I'd like to cover, Maud, before you go. One is industrialization. You started off with that. In China, they're using huge quantities of water to make sneakers and God knows what that none of us really need. It is industrialization, A, that's using the water, and B, polluting it, right? I mean, I have to say that almost everywhere I go in North America, I know that most streams are polluted, whereas thank God in Australia, if we have any streams left, you know, many of them are still clean. We've really totally gotten out of control, and isn't that sort of reflected in what Wall Street did and the sort of excessive use of capitalism and where it's led us all?
Yes, absolutely. And I mean, I keep saying, if we trusted these people with our money, why would we trust them with our water? But yes, I mean, we have really allowed unbridled pollution. And there is quite a bit here, too. Actually, there are 80,000 toxic containers under the major cities in Australia. And I'm working here with a group called Rivers SOS, who are very concerned about the pollution that's caused by mining and coal mining in particular, and are calling for a 1 kilometer buffer zone around all waterways where mining is taking place. So you're right, it's not as bad here as it is in the United States, for instance. It's not as bad in my country as it is in the United States. But nevertheless, industry has been given a free rein, I think, in far too many parts of all around the world.
Well, in the middle of our desert, in South Australia, there's a huge uranium and copper mine called Olympic Dam, and they are using 33 million litres per day out of the Great Artesian Basin, which feeds cattle stations and Aboriginal people from Mound Springs and the like. And that water becomes polluted with radiation, and it either is evaporated in ponds, the birds drink it and they die, or it goes back into the underground water system. And we don't know how long that water's been in the Great Artesian Basin. It's a vast area, and here they are, and they're about to enlarge Olympic Dam to make nuclear power plants and nuclear weapons 3 times. They're going to enlarge it by 3.
That's just appalling. And and I go back to my principle.
Yeah.
If we said that water was a public trust.
Yeah.
And a human right.
Yeah.
And had to be preserved in the ecosystem, right? And that we would place a priority on it that would be based on the soft path of conservation and source protection. You wouldn't be allowed to do that. And this is the thing people say, well, how will we stop it? Well, we all know we need politicians with more backbone, and we need politicians who will see beyond the 4 years that they're in
office. That's right.
But, this kind of, well, we're going to wink, wink, we're just not going to look over there.
That's right.
We have the same situation in northern Alberta with
the tar sands,
which is the massive destruction of our water table to provide energy for the United States. We have uranium mining in northern Saskatchewan and now in southern Ontario and Quebec. I mean, we're just, it's like, you know, one of my favorite quotes is Martin Luther King, who said, legislation may not change the heart, but it will restrain the heartless.
We have to have
laws, and if we mean it, and if we were to have a set of principles and a set of legislative realities that put water in the center and nature in the center and said that everything we have and are has come from nature, and if we destroy it, we destroy our future as well. If we truly understood that, what you describe about that uranium mining would not be allowed to continue. It just simply would not be allowed.
And then, last but not least, Maud Ballow, you say that global warming and drought isn't having an impact, but I have to say that in Australia, in the southeast of Australia, we're getting hardly any rain. It really is drought-stricken. And
absolutely.
I know the irrigators take water out of the Murray-Darling River, but by God, it's terribly frightening.
No, I don't mean for in any way to underestimate global warming and greenhouse gas-induced global warming, not for a moment. My point is that we mustn't underestimate that we're also contributing to this global warming by our abuse and misuse and displacement of water. If we were to return water to watersheds and really retain water and restore the ecosystems, the rain would return. The water that water then becomes a moderating influence in climate change. It doesn't mean that we don't have to confront the greenhouse gas emission and global warming, not for one minute.
And trees and forests play a large role
in rain. We cut down the trees.
Yep.
Trees drink in the water and they shoot it back out into the hydrologic cycle.
Yeah.
So my point is, if you remove the water from an area or you pave over water retentive landscape, the rain literally leaves. And so you create deserts. And the last thing a planet that's experiencing this global warming needs is more desert. So I'm just saying that understanding the water cycle is part of understanding the larger issue, and it's also part of the solution. I remember with your former Prime Minister Howard, he would basically say, well, there's nothing we've done. It's global warming, and it's from another place. In other words, there's nothing we're doing wrong here. And that I think, is a mistake.
Well,
it's kind of like global warming made me do it, right?
He was a scientifically illiterate man, as are actually most politicians. If you don't know.
I think that your current government here is trying really hard. I mean, I do feel a difference in the acknowledgement of climate change and so on, but they still bought into this private future. They're still allowing the privatization of the Murray-Darling. And I think in the end, the issues are startling and need a very, very powerful new way of looking at them.
Well, our current government is still in the pocket of the coal companies and the uranium companies. And so from my perspective and global warming and nuclear power, nuclear weapons, I just think they're very guilty.
And only sound better, which is very
They sound better. Yeah, that's right. They sound better.
Well, we got a powerful citizens movement growing everywhere. And thanks in so many ways to you, Helen.
Well, no, Maud, you're doing the most marvelous job throughout the world. And I have to say what a pleasure and privilege it was to interview you. And just know that Maud Ballow is one of the most famous women in Canada and indeed the world at this time.
Well, lovely to talk to you, Helen. We'll do it again.
Okay, soon, Maud.
All right.
Thank
Bye-bye
you. Bye bye. My guest today on If You Love This Planet is Maud Ballow, the National Chairperson of the Council of Canadians and Senior Advisor on Water to the President of the United Nations General Assembly. For more information, go to www.canadians.org. www.canadians.org. In the context of what we discussed today, you know, there are so many facets of our current lives which are impacting upon the natural cycles of the planet. And I think it is imperative upon us to learn as much as we can about everything that's discussed on this program every week, because then if we get a vast collected knowledge or collective knowledge and vast information, we can then use our democracies and not allow the politicians to be in the pockets of the multinational corporations, but to say, okay, you now represent us and you're going to do what we want and spend our tax dollars on us and not be privy or shills or sycophants to the corporations. I think that sort of attitude has had its day, and I think it's time we got back to caring for each other, caring for society, caring for other countries, and caring for this beloved planet of ours. You're listening to If You Love This Planet, and now we're going to hear an excerpt from a speech that I gave in Vermont at Middlebury College in April 2009. It's about the medical implications of nuclear power, and in particular relating to a very old, dilapidated nuclear reactor called Vermont Yankee, which is built right on the border of Massachusetts and Vermont. Well, I feel really honoured to have Bill McKibben to introduce me. He's one of my heroes, and everyone talks about him, and I've read his books, so maybe we're all banding together to save the planet. I'm going to walk you through. I don't care about money very much. I'm a doctor, and money's never interested me, and I hear that the argument at the moment about Vermont Yankee is about money, which is just a red herring. It's like, you know, if you've got some really difficult things to do politically, well, you get into sex and gay marriage and stuff, which takes you off track. So I want to talk about the medical implications of the whole nuclear fuel cycle, from uranium mining all the way through to Vermont Yankee radioactive waste, an operating reactor, and why this thing has to be shut down. And I come from Australia, where we've got 40% of the world's richest uranium, and we've got a very bad government who's in the pocket of the coal industry, and we've got lots of coal. And if you look out at sea where I live, there are like 15 to 30 tankers at any one time waiting to load the coal up at Newcastle to take it to China. And we're already above the level that we should be to prevent global warming. We're at 385 parts per million, and some government politicians who are scientifically illiterate, most of them are, including Obama, say, well, we can go up to 550 parts per billion. Obama's not saying that, but many are, including my Prime Minister, because he's in the pocket of the coal companies, in the pocket of the nuclear companies. And how do we get politicians to represent us and our children and our grandchildren and all other species on Earth? As a biologist now, I speak. You can't smell radiation. You can't taste it in the food and say, I can taste the radiation in this Hershey's milk bar, chocolate bar. And you can't smell it. It's invisible to the senses. It's really scary stuff. And, you know, people at the moment are all talking about costs and stuff, but I tell you what, if Vermont Yankee melts down, there will be pandemonium like there was at Three Mile Island. The doctors knew, and they fled with their families, leaving their patients in the hospitals to fend for themselves. There's a study in this book done by Union of Concerned Scientists about a meltdown at Indian Point, 35 miles from Manhattan. Can you imagine? Well, they've got sirens, and the sirens go, ooh, and everyone realises, and the radio says there's a meltdown at Indian Point. Where do you go? Well, you rush to the school to pick up your children. You rush to get your spouse, and there's total gridlock on those roads in Westchester, where the wealthy live. Then it flows down if the wind's blowing the right direction towards and hits Manhattan just in less than an hour. The bridges are blocked, the Lincoln Tunnel's blocked, no one can get out, and people get irradiated. Up to 500,000 people could die of acute radiation illness. There's a thing called ground shine. If you get out, the radioactive elements, short-lived, that land on the ground, shine back huge amounts of gamma radiation. You're in a very high radiation field. If you get a very high dose of radiation, your hair drops out, you start bleeding around your gums, you get vomiting and bloody diarrhea, and you die of massive hemorrhage or infection. In fact, at Chernobyl, where the nuclear power industry say only 56 people died, they brought in 600,000 soldiers to clean up the spent fuel rods, which came from, there was a massive explosion, bits of spent fuel rod. If you stand next to one spent fuel rod after it's been in the reactor for a year, you'll get such a dose of radiation, you'll die within days. These men were given buckets and told to go around and pick up these bits of spent in their bare hands. Within a day, they developed what's called nuclear tan. They all turned brown. Their legs and arms swelled so much the skin split, and their head in their brain swelled, and the brain's in a fixed box. There's no room for swelling, so they developed ataxia like drunk people. They got severe headaches, seizures, and they died in 3 days. About 6,000 people have died, but already I think there are more, and many of the others are getting cancer. There's an epidemic of leukemia and children living in the Ukraine and Belarus. There are homes, there's a wonderful film called Chernobyl Heart. There are homes full of deformed children, and my colleagues, pediatricians, said they've never seen anything like it. There's a deficit of wild animals around there because people have been moved out from the environment. Now, cesium lasts 600 years, strontium lasts 600 years, plutonium lasts 500,000 years. There's Europe, and you can see England here. There are farms in Cumbria and in Wales growing lambs whose lambs are so full of cesium-137 they can't sell them on the market. They send them to paddocks, fields where there is less cesium to sort of dilute the cesium, but they're still radioactive. 40%, and you can see that, of the European landmass is still radioactive and will be for hundreds of years. The British government went to see the farmers and said, you've got to stop growing your lambs and selling them. And they said, well, for how long? And they said, oh, about 100 years, but it's not. I do not buy European food. I look on the labels. I don't buy Spanish olive oil. I don't buy Italian tomatoes. Turkey got a hell of a fallout. Don't buy Turkey's exporting a lot of dried apricots, a lot of dried tomatoes. Turkey got a hell of a fallout. And I went to my health food shop and there were Turkish apricots. Australia makes lovely dried apricots. Why have we got Turkish apricots? God only knows. And I said, are these radioactive? And the man said, well, they're organic. The truth is all food's organic. Okay, so we've talked about routine releases. They call these releases routine because they have to release it all the time. So living near a reactor, you're at particular danger of developing a malignancy, particularly if you're a child or a baby in utero. One X-ray to the pregnant abdomen doubles the incidence of leukemia in that baby. So that's why when you go and have an X-ray, they say, when is your last period? To make sure you haven't conceived and there's a tiny little embryo in there, conceptus. Now, how could a meltdown occur? Well, it's easy. I could produce a meltdown in a flash. All nuclear power plants are dependent upon a source of external electricity to keep this cooling water circulating, because if you lose it, the reactor melts down in a couple of hours. I was outside Indian Point recently, two reactors 35 miles from Manhattan, each using 1 million gallons of water a minute from the Hudson. I could have driven a little speedboat armed with Timothy McVeigh explosives into those pipes, and within two hours the radiation would probably have been heading towards Manhattan. So you've got external electricity, you've got this. You could infiltrate into the control room and pretend you're a controller, press the wrong knob, which happened at Chernobyl and at Three Mile Island, and produce a meltdown. The older reactors get, the more embrittled the pipes become because of all the neutron radiation, they fall apart. This is nearly 40 years old. They were designed to be only 30 to 40 years before they were closed down. They want to extend the lifespan for another 20 years. With embrittled pipes. And they pushed up the power to be operating I don't know, instead of 3% enrichment, they push it up to about 4.5%. The power goes up and the things start shaking, these reactors, and the pipes fall apart. They fall to bits. Why? Because all the cost of building a reactor, and they now cost 12 to 15 billion to build, according to Standard & Poor's, huge. Once you've got it built and you pay for it, because it's a socialised industry in a capitalist society, so are the bombs socialised, so is the Pentagon socialised, but your healthcare isn't. So to build it is expensive. So once the capital cost is covered, then the people who take it over, like Entergy, they just charge you an arm and a leg for the electricity, or actually two-thirds of it goes to Massachusetts. So you are housing a reactor where the electricity is being sold in Massachusetts. And if it melts down and the wind's blowing up here, you'll get it. And actually, during the Chernobyl accident, the wind changed 360 degrees during a 24-hour period. So you never know where the wind's going to blow. But it's cheaper not to build a reactor but to sell the electricity, and it's wicked. Every year, 30 tonnes of spent fuel rods are removed from this reactor because they become inefficient, packed with fission products, and they're located in, they call them swimming pools, euphemistically, beside the reactor, packed on racks. And this, apparently, this thing is covered with a tin roof. And I've got a study in this book to show from Princeton that there's up to 30 times more radiation in the cooling pool than there is in the reactor itself. So if you're a terrorist, I mean, you can just... And apparently radar from the airports doesn't cover Vermont Yankee. And so you can fire a little plane, just a little plane into that, and produce a meltdown in the cooling pool and lose the water, and that's it. Or if you're a terrorist, you fire a shoulder-held missile at it and there's a meltdown in the cooling pool, which would kill far more many people than a reactor meltdown itself. So you're sitting on a time bomb. These are really nuclear bombs in your midst. They don't explode, although Chernobyl did. And there was a hydrogen explosion too at Three Mile Island when Jimmy Carter took Rosalind in, remember, in the yellow boots? Okay, now I'll just walk through the major components. Not all of them. There are, when uranium fissions, it produces 200 new elements, none of which existed before. Some last seconds and some last millions of years. A lot of them are up on that periodic table. But let's walk through several. I-131, half-life 6 days. It's around for about 8 days. It's around for about 6 weeks. Where does iodine go? Thyroid. I was irradiated because the British, we don't like the British in Australia, we think they're arrogant, we call them POMs, came to Australia and blew up their hydrogen bombs. The wind changed and blew over Adelaide. Someone measured the thyroids of sheep and they were absolutely full of radioactive iodine. No one measured the thyroids of people. I've got a multinodular goiter, which is pre-malignant, so does my brother. And I've treated quite a few patients dying of thyroid cancer at the Royal Adelaide Hospital. The next one is strontium 90. Oh, this is a beta emitter. Remember that electron? And it's a gamma emitter too, like X-rays. Strontium 90 is the same beta and gamma. Half-life 28 years, so it's around for 600. It's a calcium analog, like radium. So it goes to the bone and teeth where it can cause bone cancer and leukemia, and that's how Barry Commoner and Linus Pauling got Jack Kennedy to stop testing above ground because they were finding strontium 90 in children's deciduous teeth and saying these children could get cancer and leukemia. Cesium-137 is, I've told you, a potassium analog, lasts for 600 years. It's a beta and a gamma. And it causes rare muscle sarcomas called rhabdomyosarcomas. Where I lived on Long Island, there's the Brookhaven National Labs. A lot of cesium got out and there was an epidemic of children with rhabdomyosarcoma living there. Causes brain cancers, gets into the ovary and the testicles. Last but not least is plutonium, named after the god of hell. It's an alpha. Less than a millionth of a gram, 10 to the minus 6 grams, is carcinogenic. But when they injected plutonium into beagle dogs, they didn't find a dose low enough that didn't give every dog cancer. So it's infinitesimal, the dose that causes cancer. Each reactor makes, a 1,000 megawatt reactor, makes 500 pounds of plutonium a year, and 5 to 10 pounds is critical mass. The smaller bombs, they can make it out of 5 pounds. So theoretically, a country that has a reactor can make up to 50 bombs a year. So these are bomb factories. They're cancer factories and they're bomb factories. Plutonium is interesting, though, because it's handled like iron by the body. It's absorbed into the lung, so it can be inhaled, and it can cause lung cancer. It can be transferred by white blood cells to the mediastinal lymph glands, where it can cause leukemia or Hodgkin's or lymphoma. It combines with the iron transporting protein, transferrin, so it's taken to the liver and stored in the liver, where it can cause liver cancer. It's taken to the bone, of course, because the red blood cells are made in the bone and they contain iron. It actually crosses the placenta into the developing embryo, where, like the drug thalidomide, it can cause gross congenital anomalies like depleted uranium. And it also has a predilection for testicles. And every male in the northern hemisphere has a tiny load of plutonium in his testicles. Testicular cancer is increasing, and it will be many generations before we see what's really going on. They've made thousands of tons of plutonium, both in the weapons industry and the reactor industry. This is wicked. It's criminal. I am sick and tired of sitting by the beds of children, helping them to die. The parents never recover. To tell a girl aged 18 who suddenly got blind that she's got acute leukemia and she's dead in a week. My father died of cancer in 3 weeks. He was 51. He built two houses out of asbestos. Cancer's the most debilitating, degrading disease with tremendous pain. We are trying to prevent cancer. We have the Breast Cancer Week. I saw it's the Children March for Dimes. If we want to prevent children with genetic diseases and deformities, we close down every single one of these things within a year. You've got 103 reactors in your country, and this is the only state with a law that can close the reactor down. And if you do that, like you voted for gay marriage, you are going to be a prototype for the whole country and indeed the world. This is Helen Caldicott, and that was a lecture I gave at Middlebury College in Vermont in April 2009 about the medical implications of nuclear power. The website for If You Love This Planet is ifyoulovethisplanet.org, and thank you very much for listening, and we look forward to next week with another fascinating guest.
You've been listening to If You Love This Planet with Dr. Helen Caldicott. This program is broadcast on community radio across the United States, including our host station, KPFT Pacifica, Houston, Texas. This program is produced and engineered by Jazz Williams, co-produced by Scott Powell, and our publicity and outreach are coordinated by Amanda Bellerby. To listen to previous shows or to make a donation, go to our website, ifyoulovethisplanet.org.